Hello, and welcome to the See Me podcast. I'm Finlay, just here to give a very brief introduction to today's episode. Our guest today is Professor David Waits, Malincourt Professor of Physics and of Applied Physics, Harvard. And we're very honoured and thankful to him for agreeing to be on the podcast, which was recorded shortly after him giving a seminar over at the University of Strathclyde. David's research focuses on the study of soft condensed matter, and he chats about his research as well as some more fundamental questions about science and research in today's world with Lorna, one of our colleagues over at Strathclyde. And again, I'm super thankful to Lorna for hosting this episode, and I hope that it will be the first of many. I personally found this discussion to be very frank and insightful, and I hope that you all enjoy it. Now, without further ado, here's Lorna Merritt and Professor David Waits.
I'm Lorna Merritt. I'm recording a podcast for SEMI, on behalf of SEMI. I'm here with Professor David Waits. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Dave Waits. Good to be here.
We're recording this at University of Strathclyde. I'm going to launch in with the questions. So I thought I'd start off with kind of more maybe meta science sort of questions. You gave us a lecture earlier in the day, and there were some great questions at the end of kind of curiosity-based science. So I had a question, do you think curiosity is a driver enough for science, or does there always need to be a societal driver for good science to happen?
There needs to be a driver for good science. It doesn't have to be societal. It doesn't have to be to make society better. But I think if you don't do something that has a purpose to do something important, then you're not doing the right thing. Because you can be curious about anything.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, absolutely. What would you say the best qualities in your, I guess, best postdocs and PhD students in your lab, what qualities would you say they embody, all of them?
They don't listen to me.
They don't listen to you. So there needs to be a part of curiosity and rebellion?
No.
No?
It doesn't have to be rebellion. It means they have to be independent. They have to do what they think is right.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell them what I think is right, but they should decide whether that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And the best ones are the ones who prove me wrong.
Nice. Okay. So that's the message for everyone. Prove your PIs wrong and don't take their word for it, I guess.
Absolutely.
Also, if you were to start your long career again, would you still choose to go into the area of soft matter physics?
No. Uh-huh. Well, yes, now I would. And what I do, I'd probably do the same. I like it. But, you know, when you're a student, you should do something you like, but it doesn't mean that that's what you'll do your whole career.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing to learn.
Yeah. There might be some undergraduates from Glasgow and Strathclyde listening to this podcast. I've asked you what the kind of best qualities are in PhD students and postdocs. I know you teach kind of introductory science to like future doctors. What sort of qualities do you see in those that kind of are promising?
A willingness to learn and to learn something different. Learn something
new. Yeah, okay. My project, my PhD, is funded by ARIA, which is kind of modelled on the ARPA model in the US. They're trying to kind of still find the balance between kind of immediate applications and kind of foundational research. I know you kind of answered and alluded to this question in our previous discussion, but how do you find that balance between foundational kind of fundamental curiosity based research and kind of immediate applications that kind of make money?
I think you have it all wrong. There's no such thing as basic research and applied research. There's mm-hmm. only good research and bad research. You can do applied research, it's very good. You can do fundamental research, it's very good. I think if you do fundamental research, it shouldn't be just something that you say, I'm doing because I'm curious. And you can be curious in anything.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you doing it? What's the goal? Where are you going?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that you're going to change the world. It doesn't have to be some money, it doesn't have to be life. It could also be, I'm going to learn something new about science. But what new are you going to learn? How is it going to be important?
Mm-hmm.
You always have to ask that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
ARIA, DARPA doesn't ask that. DARPA has a very clear goal. They want to do this. And there's nothing wrong with that either. It's great research.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have a favorite funding model for science research?
Yes.
Yeah?
Whatever works.
Whatever works. That's
wherever
correct.
I get money.
So
in the US, if it's green, it works.
Yeah, yeah. So if you obviously funders would quite like kind of an output that gets money or kind of immediate applications. Are you able to kind of in like coat kind of a foundational research? I know you said that it's good or bad research, but are you able to kind of coat foundational research with kind of an immediate applications case to kind
no,
of get
I
it
look
in
it
there?
Differently. I can take applied research and find what's mm-hmm. foundational about that.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy to work with industry. I'm very happy to solve their problems, but I'll do it by that. By doing science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's all about kind of this perspective that you kind of
yeah.
approach it from.
And I'm a scientist, so I'm going to do science.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can do that for anything that's applied, mm-hmm. most things that apply.
Yeah. So we've talked about curiosity-driven science. There's obviously a massive difference between kind of the research culture in the US and the UK and Europe, kind of in the way that we teach our university students, I'd say. Would you agree? No?
Yeah.
No? How do you think we're the same?
Well, if you study physics, there's a certain amount of physics that you need to learn. And I don't think it's different where you learn.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same.
Yeah. I mean, the kind of, I suppose, risk, the kind of culture around risk-taking here is probably a bit different that might translate.
Not when you're, no? Not when you're teaching.
No. On the side of university, kind of the way that we rear kind of future researchers, I guess, do you think universities have got it correct at the moment of how to create curious researchers? If they haven't got it right, how would you reckon universities can kind of foster that curiosity in students rather than kind of getting information dictated to them? And...
I don't think a university teaches anything. It's professors that teach. And so I think if professors encourage their students to think for themselves,
mm-hmm.
to do things on their own, and to always ask questions. Also, I think the most important thing is to always ask, why are you doing what you're doing? Just because you're curious about it is not a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
just not. So anybody who says they do curiosity-driven research probably is doing boring research.
Okay.
They have a reason for doing it. Good. I think if the professors do that, the students will do that.
Yeah. Currently, From Europe and the UK, we're obviously looking into the US and kind of seeing everything that's happening. I probably already know the answer to this question, but has there been a meaningful change in the way that you approach science now, kind of now and 6 months ago, before and after the election?
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure.
How are you kind of adapt? Are you adapting kind of the way you write grants?
Yeah, can't do science anymore.
You can't do science?
Can't write grants.
Okay.
So we're all wondering how we're going to support ourselves.
Do you think that, I remember when Brexit happened, when I was 16 years old, and I remember everyone kind of saying that there was going to be a massive brain drain from the UK to the EU. Do you think this is something that will happen for the US?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe people leaving from the US to Europe, Canada?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think people will leave. I think people won't come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to destroy science for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. So your research lab, you're saying that you're loads of you are immigrants, and the US is kind of made up of immigrants. Will this? How do you foresee how the Trump administration will impact how you are trying to bring talent to your group?
I mean, it probably won't have that much an effect in my group, except I won't have money to support people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Probably I can't bring people from China.
Mm-hmm.
They're very good people in China. But I think what the whole tenor is that the people who want to come, there'll be fewer and fewer people who want to come. Because it's just not a good place to come. It's not a good place to stay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just Trump. It's the country.
Yeah.
The country elected.
Yeah, yeah. On that vein, do you think that the U.S., would kind of improve the way that they do science outreach to the general population to kind of battle that sort of like anti-science?
Well, I would say we failed.
Mm-hmm.
It's as simple as that. We failed.
Yeah.
Because the public doesn't believe in science.
If you were to if you were to try and fix that, how would you go about it?
I can't do it. I think it's all done through social media. I don't know how to communicate through social media. You know. You have to convince the public that what you're doing makes sense. You have to convince the public that taking vaccines makes sense. You have to convince the public that funding science actually leads to prosperity.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do that.
Maybe communicating science modules should be more normalized in university curricula, maybe.
I don't know. Do you really think that people flipping through Facebook or whatever they do are going to look at science modules?
Mm. No.
Okay, so how are you going to do it?
Yeah. No, I suppose it kind of starts from the ground up with the way that we teach kids, I guess, and you try and...
It's not even that. It's the way you communicate. How do you communicate to people who only look at a very narrow source of information? I don't know how to do that. I don't do that. So I don't know how to do it. You know that.
Yeah.
You have to do it.
There are quite a few popular Instagram accounts, the Institute for Advanced Study, and also Oxford Mathematics are two of my favorite kind of institutions that have managed to kind of get that sort of social media following, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers that are kind of interested in modern science and mathematics through these kind of old institutions. Maybe we should all take a leaf out of their book. I'm going to kind of pivot to more science now. You kind of multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, kind of foot in so many different camps. Do you think the boundaries that are taught to us in maybe undergraduate science, so kind of the boundaries and silos between physics, biology, and chemistry, do you think these boundaries between these disciplines are useful, and are they holding us back for multidisciplinary research?
I mean, I think actually there's a value to being an expert in a discipline. So I think there's the silos, the traditional silos, are probably the best silos.
Mm-hmm.
The physicist, chemist, biologist is still valuable.
Mm-hmm.
As an undergraduate, part of your graduate training. But once you do that, then you have to be willing to broaden your mind. I don't think that learning a little bit about a lot of disciplines is actually that good.
Mm-hmm,
you learn a lot about a few disciplines and then become less specialized as you learn more. That's what I did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm reminded of a question that one of the faculty here, Peter Childs, gave in a guest lecture ages ago. Do you think it's easier for a biologist to be trained in physics, or do you think it's easier for a physicist to be trained in biology?
Same difficulty.
Really?
Yeah.
As I did my undergraduate in physics, and I transferred to kind of biomedical and biology further in my PhD. I found it a completely different world. But I think physics has equipped me kind of be able to kind of look under the hood, I guess. I was wondering if you had any kind of PhD
well,
students.
I think exactly the same.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think that biologists, I know some biologists who, I can think of one in particular, I just find him frighteningly smart.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And he understands it, not perfectly, but he understands everything. He's got an open mind, he understands biology. He can do fine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have very high regard for him.
Yeah.
He's one of my really favorite scientists.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't know whether Kimmy has told you about the kind of goal to kind of bring polymaths together. I'm aware that kind of the scientific field and culture at the moment is very kind of individualistic, I'd say, maybe. Compared to, I'm kind of reminded of kind of the dawn of thermodynamics and kind of 1700 science, 1800 science, where there's kind of dedicated groups that come together maybe every month that kind of come to discuss ideas. Do you think that modern science should kind of facilitate this more kind of social kind of get-togethers of scientists? Do you practice that?
No. I mean, I think it's the wrong thing to do because once a month you go and talk to other people, like going have a drink once a month. It's exactly the wrong thing. I work with people.
Mm-hmm.
I go and talk to them. I talk to them every day. I run into the hall. I talk to them. I discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to do science. It's not once a month. It's not just some social meeting is to do science. You do science with them. You work with them.
Yeah.
So this idea of some cultural thing, just culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun. It's interesting, but it's not science.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question about kind of your microfluidics work. I am not, my PhD project doesn't focus on microfluidics, but our research group uses a lot of them. Microfluidics and kind of soft lithography, you obviously need quite a expertise kind of training to kind of use it for before you can kind of like get to grips with it and use it on your own. Does this kind of pose a barrier to kind of trying to get this out to other disciplines? Obviously, microfluidics is such a powerful tool. I think sometimes it gets focused in the hands of maybe biomedical engineers and physicists when it could be kind of distributed to other disciplines. Along that similar vein, do you ever see kind of microfluidics getting maybe promoted to more like point of care, kind of democratized sort of like futures, such as kind of like diagnostics, maybe in like war zones and that sort of stuff?
Well, you're asking me a lot of different questions.
I know, I realize
First
that.
First of all, I think what George Whiteside has done with microfluidics has democratized it completely. So I think you can come to my lab and a week later, you're completely skilled in microfluidics. There's nothing complicated. If you try and go and make a traditional silicon chip that takes you months, now you can't even do it, right? You go to these factories that are just enormous factories. It's so complicated, it's ridiculous. You don't even make your own chips. You design it and you send it out. 3 months later, you get some chip. That's different.
Yeah.
Microfluidics is easy. But I think even then, you should only use it when you need to. And can you democratize science? Can you do things that will help point of care? I mean, the answer is yes. We think about that all the time. Sure, we think about doing things like that. Commercialization, not that I've done, but some of the people from my group have done, has been to democratize diagnostics. We ask similar questions, maybe not necessarily, sometimes point of care, but trying to do things, trying to make tests that are much less expensive. But that's really, really good science, I think. And microfluidics is just one of the tools. I think the research in microfluidics is done. There's not a lot of research left, at least from my perspective.
Yeah. Well, we'll try and prove you wrong then. There you go.
Exactly. I'm sure you will.
I thought I'd ask you a few quick questions about sort of biophysics. What excites you most about the area of biology, any area in biology, but what excites you most about biology as a soft matter physicist?
Soft matter?
Yeah.
Where's soft matter? Where can I apply soft matter physics to that? That's my personal passion, my personal goal. I mean, if I look at biology, the way I look at it is, what is it, maybe 100 years ago, 120 years ago, that was the golden era of physics. Right? Mm-hmm. That's when the new equations, the new laws were discovered. That doesn't happen anymore. Still, physics is wonderful. You understand what's around you. You're not going to find new laws. Biology is a place where you can apply that concept or laws to be discovered. Will they be discovered? I don't know. That's my call. That's what I'd like to see. So to me, biology is the of the traditional disciplines, chemistry, physics, mathematics, biology is the science of today. It's the area that's massively exploding. It's the area where really you can do something in biology, you can win a Nobel Prize 5 years later. Physically, they're still giving Nobel Prizes for 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Just because things don't evolve. And so I look at these things, I see the biologists doing all this work, and I say, I'm not going to let them have all the fun. I'm going to be part of it.
Yeah, that's good news for us at SEMI then, isn't it? I've got two more questions, and then we'll wrap it up. Yes. I've been asked to keep it short and sweet. I can never keep stuff short and sweet when I talk. But I am very interested in kind of non-equilibrium thermodynamics and also kind of stochasticity as a kind of tool of biology. So would you say that randomness is a problem to overcome, or is it a feature for us to kind of harness and use?
it is what it is. It's there. So we have to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can harness it. Sometimes you have to live with it. Sometimes it gets in the way. Sometimes it adds to the beauty. I see a lot of my colleagues saying they're going to understand non-equilibrium physics. And I say, good. I'll come back when you do.
Yes.
It's not going to happen in my lifetime.
Yes.
But I'm going to still use it. I'm not going to shy away from it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe non-equilibrium thermodynamics is like the quantum mechanics of the modern day, maybe. If you think you understand it, you don't.
Well, no, maybe somebody will figure it out.
Yeah.
But I see a lot of people trying. And I see very few people making progress. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, obviously, when we talk about like Nobel Prize in physics and kind of the big physics discoveries of the last century, do you think that biology has the potential to have these sort of unifying laws?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's a very out there question, isn't it?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope I'll see them.
Yeah.
But a lot of people will tell me, no, I'm full of shit.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. And so I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to look for them. Prove me wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to find unifying laws as well. So you build a lot of stuff with your hands. In the lab, yeah?
Not me.
Not you. Well, would you say that building your own equipment as a scientist or any researcher, would you say that building your own equipment kind of helps you to think differently about your kind of research perspective?
Let me just change it slightly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's so much building your own equipment, but doing things that are not commercial, not doing things differently, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So building equipment, I don't think it's the key, but using tools differently, yes,
yeah.
It absolutely does.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you need to build really exotic, fancy, but simple things can tell you a lot of good information. What I think I've done over my career is try to ask, can I make simple measurements that tell me something very informative. And so it's not so much building equipment, it's learning how to use it in a way that is a little bit outside of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yes, I think is very important.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of kind of equipment, what do you see as kind of one of the biggest bottlenecks that you've got at the moment in your lab? Do you have any bottlenecks at the moment in your lab?
Many. Never have enough equipment because there's never enough money. It all comes down to money. We're always out of money.
So do you foresee more bottlenecks coming up in the future as you are unable to get money?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
but I mean, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's going to get worse. On the other hand, it's been pretty bad all along. And I think that if you're sort of hungry, if you don't have everything you need, if you don't have all the tools that you necessarily need, that leads to a lot of innovation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you shouldn't have everything you need. You should have only barely enough.
Yeah, build it up. So you do a lot of kind of spin-out companies and kind of straddle industry and academia. With the current academic climate, research climate, political climate, would you say to a kind of prospective PhD student to do a PhD, or would you encourage them to go to industry first?
I would say you should do a PhD even if you want to go to industry. I think that if you don't have a PhD, you'll be more constrained in what you can do in industry. It's not bad, you can have a great career, but if you really want to have a career of doing something that is inventive, something new and different and always changing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's always the case. Current climate is what it is. It's going to change.
Yeah.
Will it get better? Well, I keep thinking it's going to get better, but it's always gotten worse. Eventually it'll get better.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. last question on the kind of spin-out topic. What would you say, in your experience, are kind of the key qualities of successful spin-outs?
They have to be built on a good idea. They have to recognize that whatever their good idea that they started with is likely not the right idea. They have to be able to change and go in new directions. They have to be flexible, and don't know, things have to conspire to make them really successful, and that's really tough.
Mm-hmm.
If I knew what it was, I'd be doing it right away.
True, yeah, everyone would be successful, yes. Okay, I know I've said a last question multiple times now, but this is the last question. do you have an experience that you can look back at, maybe when you were at university or starting your PhD, that kind of sparked that interest that kind of led you down your career that you've taken?
No, I think it's just curiosity. It's always wanting to learn something new.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the best thing I've ever done is?
What?
The next thing.
The next thing. Ah, the best thing you can do is the next thing. I think we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much, David. It's been a pleasure having you. Thank you very much.
No problem.